A More Just Environment, Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial, community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience, to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. And that is the KKFI mission statement. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. Today, host David Bell has a discussion with his guest, Reggie, a man who has spent his adult life in prison for a crime he committed when he was 17. We hope you stay tuned in for a discussion on a horrible crime, his sentence, time in prison, treatment, and how Reggie has come to terms with all of this. Our show is very different from facts of the actual crime that people find so entertaining in crime dramas, both written and performed. David and Reggie delve into motivations and realizations. Psychologists are not only providing treatment to prisoners, they're also contributing to debate over the nature of prison itself. Because Reggie had a sex offense, he has received psychological treatment. Listeners will hear how Reggie has changed as a result of his crime and maybe from this treatment. Instead of the drone of hours behind bars, he was offered a guided examination of the impetus and the result of his crime. Jaws of Justice would like to take our listeners through an examination of rehabilitation. Isn't this what we want? We hope you can listen. On Jaws of Justice, we investigate how to achieve justice in America. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
You know, I'm often asked by people how I do the work that I do. How can you represent criminals? How can you represent those people? And my answer is as follows. None of us should ever be solely defined by the worst thing that we've ever done. There's a spark of the divine in all of us. And as a result, we are all capable of doing both the best things imaginable and the worst things imaginable. This last one is scary to people because I believe there's almost a social survival mechanism that kicks in to label another in such a manner to create a perceived distance between two people. Labels like convict, felon, sex offender, criminal, labels. Today we speak with someone that committed horrific offenses, forcible rape and sodomy of an adult woman. This person, who we will call Reggie, is willing to talk to us about his upbringing, his crime, his treatment, and his almost 30 years of incarceration. There may be some people bothered by me having Reggie on the show, that I am somehow okay with his actions. My response is that by affirming Reggie's humanity, I'm not trying to disavow the humanity of any other person. Ultimately, I want a criminal justice system that treats all people as people, while at the same time recognizing and responding to what we are all capable of doing to each other. Finally, the person I'm referring to as Reggie offered to come on using his real name and other identifiers. Because he's still subject to some obligations in the state in which he lives, I requested, perhaps the criminal defense attorney in me requested, that we use a pseudonym, and further, that we slightly change some of the identifiers as part of the show. With that, we welcome Reggie. Reggie, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, David.
So I guess I first want to start out, you know, a lot of times the work that I do, I'm always looking to some reason for the behavior, something that we can go back in the past. And when I met with you and spoke to you, nothing really popped out, although there's certain things along the way that I think we can look to and say potentially this increased the likelihood of something happening. We couldn't say this necessarily, but increased the likelihood. And so as we go through your kind of upbringing a little bit, maybe we can talk about some of that. I guess the first thing is, I guess first we'll start out, Reggie, you're 48 years old. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And you're born in the Midwest?
Yes.
With two siblings?
Yes, I have two siblings.
Okay, and I guess describe for us kind of the early upbringing, if you will, maybe up to the age of 12. How would you describe your family life, in general about your mom and dad, things that can help us kind of give context.
I came up in a household where my mother and my father was married. And, I had two sisters, and, it was a good household. You know, they sent me and my sisters to church on Sunday. And, I went to school. No, I went to grade school in Kansas. I went to grade school, junior high, and my high school all in the Midwest. And I mean, my family home, it was a nice home. It was a pretty good upbringing. My father was a military man. And my mother was like a stay-at-home wife and a mother. So, and they was together for a long time. I mean, in my opinion, most families, it was good times and bad times, mostly good. And, my parents argue like most couples do. They had their differences. Nobody sees eye to eye all the time. But they, for the most part, they kept that away from me and my siblings, and they tried to, solve their differences of opinions or whatnot between the adults rather than, me and my, siblings, listen to it and this and that. And, I came up in a pretty good household. My father, we played sports together. He talked to me a lot about sports. My mother was more so about school, but me and my father, we talked about sports together, watched sports together and things of that nature. And, he taught me a whole lot, but however, at the age of 12, my mother and my father separated when I was 12 years old. And, up until that time, my mother was a stay-at-home wife, as I mentioned before, and a mother, stay-at-home wife, mother. But when her and my father separated, she had to get a job. And, it's my belief that that was the first job that she ever had to get. And she became a CNA. And, to take care of my siblings and myself, she had to work a lot of doubles. And, working those doubles, didn't leave a lot of room for her, to be hands-on with me, myself, and my siblings. So I was the oldest. So it left a lot of room for me to just be out there and, make a lot of bad decisions, I would say. It's like, the neighborhood that I grew up in, it was a pretty rough neighborhood. And, I believe we all have choices, but, in my situation, I believe, I know that I made some bad choices, but part of that is I believe that in a way, I was pretty much a product of my environment. So in the neighborhood that I grew up in, it was a lot of drugs. It was a lot of, alcoholics. It was a lot of just bad stuff going on. At that time, I gravitated, my mother was working a lot, so I didn't hardly see her too much. So, she wasn't there to discipline me and guide me as far as the friends that I chose to be friends with, the things that I chose to do. So I tended to gravitate towards, what was there, a bad crowd. I tended to gravitate towards a bad crowd and gravitate towards that bad crowd and making one bad decision upon another bad decision, ultimately led me to committing a crime that I had to go to prison for, go to prison.
Let me stop you there for a sec. And it's always interesting in my job, Reggie, and I appreciate again you taking the time to talk to us. I'm always looking for the why. And what I found, and maybe we can talk about this before we get to the crime itself. A lot of times it's not as if one day someone wakes up and says, I'm going to go out and do really bad things. But rather what I hear you saying is that the divorce happens, or the parents separate. And that in and of itself doesn't cause you to commit this crime we're going to talk about. But it seems to me that that incident then puts you in a situation where maybe you had a less parental oversight. And then at that point, you started to gravitate towards individuals that ultimately kind of weren't making the best choices themselves. And in that, in doing that, you kind of got into that lifestyle. Does that sound right?
Yes, that sounds correct. It's like, my father was the disciplinary of my family. He disciplined all of us, and I had a very fond respect for my father. So it's like, if my father and my mother wouldn't have separated, and it's a big possibility that I wouldn't have gravitated towards the crowd that I gravitated towards.
But Reggie, what do you think it was, though? Just to help understand you, maybe myself, others, what do you think it was that once you had a little bit less oversight that got you interested in the bad crowd? Was it people that were just wearing flashier clothes, driving flashier cars? What was it about these individuals that you gravitated towards that attracted your attention?
Well, yeah, it was a little bit of that. I mean, the bad crowd that I'm speaking of, I mean, everybody wasn't bad. I personally gravitated towards a badder crowd. I mean, it's a lot of guys that I grew up with, you know, they never got into the lifestyle of committing crimes and doing the things that I personally chose to do. And, you know, they're pretty much grown men these days. They have families of their own, children of their own. Some of them may even be grandfathers. But for me personally, that played a part, you know. I like to, I've always been the type that like to get out and make my own money. You know, I like to have my own money because I like nice things. So I like to be able to go to the store, go to the mall, and if I see a pair of shoes that I like to be able to purchase those shoes without having to ask anybody else to purchase them for me. So things of that nature, you know, I mean, there's a lot of drugs in my neighborhood, the neighborhood that I grew up in. And, you know, guys that's selling drugs, you know, they had those flashy things, you know. And a lot of these guys was my age, some of them even younger than I was at that time. And, you know, they would have pockets full of money, gold jewelry, rings, necklaces, you name it. They would have cars at a young age, and you know, that type of thing. I was intrigued by that lifestyle. You know, I wanted the same things that they had. I wanted to be able to have gold jewelry, gold rings, gold necklaces. I wanted to have a car of my own. I wanted to always have money in my pocket. So that was part of the allure that caused me to gravitate towards the bad lifestyle.
And when we were talking before, I know in high school you were good in math and art. I think you were, you know, in algebra earlier than other people. You had a really good drawing and art. It sounds to me like the school thing you got, meaning you had the ability. And still have the ability, but you had the ability at the time to potentially succeed in that school environment.
Yes, I really liked this school. You know, that's where all my friends were at. That's where everything was going on in school, you know. And as you had mentioned, yeah, in school, I was an A and B student in school. I was like, I got C's here, maybe an occasional F here, but my mama didn't play that. My mama was real strict about going to school and doing your homework and all that. So I was an A and B student in school. And I believe it was my freshman year in school. At that time, I was enrolled into an advanced class at that time. And it was algebra. I was like the only freshman in the class with all seniors and juniors, you know, doing algebra. And they used to tease me talking about I was a little bookworm and this and that, and, you know. I used to be kind of like, you know, back then I used to kind of be like, I, you know, I kind of, it made me feel some type of way being teased like that. But no, hindsight is 20/20. So now I just look back at it and be like, wow, you know, I was real good at math. I always loved numbers my whole life. And, I always liked art too. I was pretty good at drawing. So, my freshman art teacher, it was like myself and maybe four or five other people. She went to the principal and requested a special class, for these five people and myself. She's basically told them, that we was in advanced in art and that she really needs to get with us because we was a lot further along than some of the other students. And, her request was granted. You know, so we ended up having our own little class for art, and she used to teach us things like how to draw people, all sorts of things. She used to teach us a lot of things, and I still remember some of those things to this day, although I don't really draw as much as I used to.
But I understand, with regard to the flashy things, in order to get that money to buy some of those things, you started gravitating towards the wrong people, and you guys started doing robberies. Is that right?
Yes, yes. So, it's like, I sold drugs. I've done robberies. I did a lot of things that I shouldn't have done. And, I mean, it was a time when I was going to get a job. And, at that time, I was going to be hired at McDonald's to be a cook. So I went up there to McDonald's for my interview. And, on my way to McDonald's, I ran across a guy that I knew from the neighborhood. He was a little bit younger than me, but this is one of the guys that I had mentioned that, had the jewelry, the gold chains and gold rings and this and that, had his own vehicle, you know, so to me, that was something that I was just like, wow, here it is. This guy's younger than me. He got plenty of money in his pocket. He got gold jewelry. He got his own car. And I was just like, why can't I have these things? You know,
when you're robbing somebody, meaning of the gun or a weapon, threatening them, maybe you can't remember back, but if you can, is there something going on in your mind is such that, like, I know what I'm about to do is not right? Or is it, that's not even really a thought process. You're with other people. They're doing it too. And so it's just like, I'm just part of this group. And that's what's in the forefront of your mind. I just help me understand that in terms of just going up with a group of people, one or two other people, just to rob someone of whatever it is the other person has.
Yeah. I mean, when I was robbing people, I knew that it wasn't right. I mean, I'm a human being. I have a conscience, you know. I mean, most people have conscience. So, you know, I have a conscience, and, you know, I know right from wrong. But when I was out there robbing people, it was a choice that I made. And, yeah, I did know that it was wrong. But at that time, my main concern was just being able to get what I wanted when I wanted it at that time. So I didn't really care about, you know, although I knew it was wrong, I didn't care that it was wrong. All I really cared about at that time was what I wanted, when I wanted it, and how I wanted it. So,
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rich.
So that is what made the whole thing about me robbing people okay for me. It's like, you know, I know it was wrong, you know, out here pulling guns on people, taking their money, and things of that nature. So, but it was okay for me because I was doing that to put money in my own pocket.
But I assume in some of these cases that the individuals that you're robbing would be fearful. I mean, and they would express that fear in their facial expressions and their voice and their behaviors. And I wonder if those images ever stuck out to you at the time, maybe not during the event, but afterwards, where something's going on in your mind where you're thinking it through, or was it just so much of a, and again, we're talking between the ages of 12 and 17 here, but Or is it just so much focused on just yourself, what you wanted and when you wanted and how you want it? These images of other people and the impact on these other people just wasn't registering, or it wasn't registering enough to really focus on.
Well, when you're out there and running around at that age, 12, 13, all the way up to 17, and you running around with guns and things of that nature, when you pull a gun on a person, I mean, you have when you got a gun, you got this false courage that you're invincible. No, at least I did. I can't speak for everybody else, but if I had a gun, I had this false courage that I was invincible and that, you know, I could take down Superman with this gun if need be. You know, so, you know, pulling a gun on somebody and, I mean, when you see the fear, you know, the fear in their face, you take all that into account. You know that you came here to take care of your business, whatever business that is. Like, if you came, you know, to rob them for their possessions, then that's what you were doing. So having a gun, it did give me false courage. Like, you know, I felt like, you know, the world was going to bend towards my will when I had the gun. And if I pulled that gun on you, I would be able to see the fear in your eyes when I pulled that gun on you. And what? That fear added to my sense, added to the sense of false courage that I had.
When I want to now move to the crime itself, and one thing in speaking to you that I was not surprised by, I guess, although it fits within how I understand things, but the actual rape itself was part of a robbery, and it sounded to me like it wasn't that it wasn't that far removed from the robbery, meaning it's not that great of a leap to go from robbery to rape, at least in your mind. And I'm wondering if you could help explain that.
Yeah, the way that I would explain it, in my mind, in hindsight, is like when you're out there committing crimes, you cannot predict how a crime would end. I mean, you might go out there one day, you might go out there and you might feel like, okay, I'm just going to do this and do that. But those things that you think you're going to do can escalate to something that you didn't think you was going to do. It's like you might go out there and you might think that, okay, I'm just going to go out here, pull this gun on a guy, and take his wallet. And then when he give me his wallet, I'm going to leave. But what if you go out there and you pull a gun on a guy and he don't want to give you his wallet? You know, and in the process of him not wanting to give you this wallet, he don't think your gun is real. And he rushes at you to try to take your gun and defend himself. And you pull the trigger. You know, because you're not going to let him take that gun away from you, because you understand how serious this situation can get. Well, you pull that trigger and a bullet goes, then you shoot this guy and it's just one shot, you know, and that bullet, penetrates this guy's body and you shoot him through the heart and he dies instantly. That's how quick a crime could be carried out, can get out of control. It's just that simple. There's no out. You cannot predict the outcome of how a crime is going to end. And in my situation, you know, I was out doing robberies and a robbery escalated into a rape. And, it wasn't something that I had intended to do. I didn't intend to go out there and rape some woman. A woman the night that I was out doing robberies, but at the same time I was with other people and I could not predict what they was going to do, you know. And so one thing led to another. We robbed a couple, and in the process of robbing that couple, one of the guys that I was with, he felt that he wanted to rape the woman. So, I mean, he was with us, and it's like, it's a mentality for real. It boils down to a mentality, all for one, one for all type of mentality, which a lot of people in gangs have. And it basically boils down to like, okay, he took it to this level. So what are you going to do? Are you going to join in? No. And, you know, get the pat on the back that you was down for whatever, or are you going to like, not do what he doing and then be potentially labeled as a snitch and have to defend yourself because this guy took it to a whole nother level. He escalated everything and then you didn't go along with it. So now because the choice that you made not to do what he did, that automatically puts you at odds with him where he looking over his shoulder because he don't know if you going to, you know, potentially tell on him, be a snitch, or whatever. So it gets rough out there sometimes. And that's basically what happened to me.
We're talking to Reggie. Reggie was convicted of rape and sodomy. He did approximately 30 years in the penitentiary. He's been nice enough to come and share his story with us. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Reggie and talk about treatment that he went through to help him better understand himself and the harm caused to others. You're listening to 90.1 KKFI, Jaws of Justice.
Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests, find out about upcoming events, and learn how to keep yourself and your family well. Tune in each week from 6 to 7 on Monday evenings or listen anytime at kkfi.org/podcasts.
Do you have an old car, truck, motorcycle, or boat that you're ready to toss? Find out how your toss can be KKFI's gain. Call Bill at 816-931-3122. That's 816-931-3122. And ask for Bill.
Now the calendar for the week of November 29th. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, you can find a vaccine. See the facts at kcmo.gov. Monday, November 29th at 2 p.m., please come out and support the KC Freedom Project. You can speak out and advocate for all innocent and wrongfully convicted Missourians at 615 East 13th, Kansas City, Missouri, outside the Missouri Attorney General's office. Monday, November 29th at 3 p.m., an online event, Monday Meets, Get to Know the Willow Domestic Violence Center on Facebook Live. Monday, November 29th at 5 p.m., Moore Square invites you to help organize neighbors around local control of the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department. You can join Moore Square on a virtual phone bank with training offered over Zoom. It's easy to join. All you need is a computer and an internet connection. If you have questions, contact moresquare.org. Tuesday, November 30 at noon, Redistricting, Fair Maps, and Voting Rights in Kansas is an online event hosted by Kansas Appleseed. Troy Spain from the Kansas Civic Engagement Table and Kansas Appleseed Legal Fellow Nicholas Shump discuss redistricting in the Kansas legislature. More info at Kansas Appleseed on Facebook. Tuesday, November 30 at 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., there will be a Congressional District 3, that's Stillwell and Bonner Springs, Kansas, redistricting town hall. If you want more information, please go to ksfairmaps.org. Thursday, December 2nd, 6 p.m., Truth and Justice is an online event hosted by Real Justice Network for anyone on or off Facebook. This is a monthly meeting where families who have lost loved ones to police violence and for those who have been harmed by law enforcement to discuss policing issues with the community and share information on how the community can help them get justice for their loved one, as well as fighting for policy changes that can impact policing. December's topic will focus on how the holidays have changed since their loved one was taken and ways to honor their lives throughout the holiday season. Also, a mental health professional will discuss grief during the holidays. More info at realjusticenetwork.org. Sunday, December 5th, change the name, Stop the Chop Rally, 1:30 to 3:30 at the bus stop on Blue Ridge Cutoff across from the BP gas station. For more info on carpools and rides, go to peaceworkskc.org. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. Please take care of yourselves and others. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. We want to thank our engineer today, Stan Thomas. My name is Terry, reminding you these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We now return to our program.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. My name is David Bell. We're here with Reggie. Reggie was convicted of forcible rape and forcible sodomy, did approximately 30 years in prison. And where we left off was he was describing the crime of rape and sodomy as he committed it. And one thing, Reggie, that I have to ask you about is when you're talking about the robberies, you said that there was something about, you know, you would see others with flashy things, and particularly in the neighborhood you were in, that attracted your attention. With regard to this, you're out with this group of guys, and one of them decides to engage in the rape, and you have to make a decision there, and the decision is, am I going to follow along with this group, or am I going to potentially be a snitch and not follow along, and then you got to look over your shoulder and stuff. It seems like that motivation in and of itself was as great, perhaps, for you as the motivation to want the nice things that got you to Robin in the begin with. Meaning that peer pressure, whatever that is, and however you would describe it, was as powerful as whatever it was motivating you to get these nice things.
Yes, peer pressure definitely played a part. You know, and it's I mean, you got a lot of, well, I was out there committing crimes, you know, so it's probably, and the crimes didn't always turn out the way that I wanted them to do. Some of the crimes that I committed, they went a lot further than what they should have. But that's the thing about crimes. You cannot really dictate how a crime is going to end. And that's what I was speaking about before the break. It's like, I mean, there are times I just, all I wanted to do was make some money. And going out to make some money escalated to me eventually, you know, committing a rape, a gang rape. So it's
I understand you never know where it's going to lead to, but I guess, Reggie, my question is, in the middle of that rape, certainly as you had described, the fear you would see in the eyes of the individuals you're robbing, it would seem to me that same fear, even worse most likely, would be present in the woman that you were assaulting, and I wonder, does that image stay in your mind today? Is that something that you reflect on today? Is it something that you try to push out? Or is it something that you've moved on from?
Well, I mean, to answer the question, no, the image is not in my mind today. I don't necessarily try to push it away. It took time. I mean, it took time for me to learn how to forgive myself. And before I could forgive myself, when I did actually learn to start forgiving myself for what I did, then it makes it easier to move on. You know, not necessarily forget what I did, because, I mean, I did what I did. There's no forgetting it, but it comes, sometimes you just got to try to move forward to life and know that this, I mean, the worst choice that you ever made does not define who you are going to be for the rest of your life. So I made a very bad decision to rob people and rape a woman. And but that decision that I made all those many years ago does not define who I am as a person today.
But let me ask you a question. How would you define the harm that you caused to that woman without necessarily knowing? I don't believe there's any contact after that, but how would you describe it? How would you imagine that what your conduct, the impact your conduct had on that person?
I imagine that what I did to her, you know, it destroyed her life. It devastated her life. I mean, I wouldn't want nobody to to just come and, you know, barbarically rape me. And, you know, those are things that happen in prison. You know, guys is right there, you know, people get raped. So, and that's something that you have to think about. Like, you did this to a person. Like, how would you feel if somebody, you know what I'm saying, a group of these guys came and, you know, barbarically, you know what I'm saying, just forcefully raped you against your will? You know, so I understand that what I did destroyed that person's life. And I understand that she may have fear of crowds. She may have fear of men. You know, there's a lot of things that my actions took away from her that she may never get back again. So, I mean, it's life-changing.
Yes. You know, the one you described a moment in your treatment. Now, and I want to be clear, we're not going through the 30 years of prison that you spent, but, and we're talking about it as if this thing was yesterday, the crime that you committed was yesterday, but it wasn't. Let's say it was approximately 30 years ago. But one of the things you talked about in the treatment for the last part of your prison sentence, you had to sit down and describe what you did to somebody else, someone else in the program. And you described for me, it was interesting, someone else in the program was responsible for telling you what that person did, and you couldn't take it, meaning the was obviously, as the person was describing what happened, it was too much for you. I wonder if you could tell our listeners just briefly about that and kind of how that resolved itself.
Okay. So, in treatment, I had to take treatment. Treatment was a great thing. It helped me out tremendously. Well, in treatment, you got a bunch of group of guys, you know, might be 10, 20, maybe 30 people in a class, and all y'all are in the same treatment class together. Well, there's a activity that you gotta cooperate with as far as like giving a person constructive and negative feedback in accordance to how they explain the details of the crime they committed. So, you know, I had to do my part in treatment, and I was listening to a person explain how he assaulted this little girl, and she was like maybe 2 or 3 years old. And listening to him explain the things that he did to this little girl, this little baby, I mean, it was hard. I mean, it was very hard for me. You know, I got very emotional, you know. And when it came time for me to do my part as far as giving him constructive feedback for the details that he explained in regards to the crime he committed, I didn't want to do it, you know. So my therapist at that time, she was like, it's your turn to give constructive feedback. So, you know, me being upset about the crime that this guy had committed, I told her I didn't have anything constructive to say about what he did or what I just heard. So, you know, me and the therapist and I, we kind of had words back and forth about that. disagreement that we had about me giving this guy constructive feedback almost got me kicked out of treatment.
But do you think you had a 12-year sentence, but do you think, Reggie, that moment where you're listening to what that man did to that young girl, do you think that's the closest you've ever come to potentially understanding what you did to the grown woman?
Yes. I mean, I understood that. I understood that I'm no better than him, you know. Although, you know, it bothered me because of what he did, you know. I mean, it bothers other people when they think about what I did. So I wasn't no better than him, you know, and that's something that I had to sit down and realize. It's like, and that's something that they teach us in treatment that, you know, one sex offense is no better than the next sex offense. You know? So it's like I had a lot of brainstorming to do, and I got there, but it took time, you know.
So from a societal standpoint, how is it, so myself, listeners, whatever, how do we know, how do we identify if there's such a way that people who are a higher likelihood to reoffend? Meaning that the concern I think a lot of people have, or I'll just say myself has, is you want people to be reintegrated in society, but at the same time, if there's an increased risk of offenses against others, particularly of this nature, then society almost wants to side with, well, just lock them up because that's the safer thing to do. And so, but then again, that's not necessarily fair. And so then we go back and forth. I'm wondering, you've been in a million group sessions, maybe individual, you've been to prison for 30 years. How is it that I would be able to evaluate someone to determine their potential threat? And maybe that's an impossibility, Reggie, but you've been through it enough. Maybe you could help us out.
Well, as far as recidivism go, it's hard to say who's going to reoffend and who's not. I mean, I don't think you really can point anybody out because anybody is capable of reoffending. It's on the person. The person has to be willing to, like, be real serious about his life and want to change to not ever reoffend again. It's all about the choices that that person makes. And I believe in treatment. The therapist, I mean, they've been doing it a long time, and they've heard a lot of things. They heard a lot of people play games. So I believe therapists can pretty much try to narrow down who's just in there to, like, get a pass and is not really serious about their treatment. All they really care about is making it back out to society. And it's like, to answer your question, I don't think you really can, like, weed out who's going to reoffend and who's not going to reoffend. It basically all boils down to the person and the decisions that that person makes. And also, the decisions that that person chooses to make will eventually be the tell-all, you know, about whether or not he or she is going to reoffend again.
Is there an experience or relationship, like with a counselor, that you would credit with your ability to kind of speak publicly about this part of your life?
Yeah. Each therapist that I had, they were great therapists. They helped me out a lot. But going into treatment, you know, it was something that I personally wanted. You know, it's like I needed to understand just as much as anybody else why I did the things why did I commit the crimes that I committed. You know, I needed to understand that I made the decision to rape a woman.
Why did you need to understand? What was it that all of a sudden in your mind said, well, I need to figure this out? Because I know doing MOSOP, which is a sex offender treatment program in prison, that gets you out earlier. So that has to be a motivation. But was there something else that gets you out that motivated you to figure out the why?
Yeah, I mean, I need to understand for myself because I wasn't raised like that. You know, when my father left, I was basically raised by a woman from the age of 12 up to the day I was convicted. And she didn't raise me like that to be forcing myself upon women, to be raping women. She didn't raise me to be out in the streets robbing people and things like that. So I really needed for myself to understand who I am as a person. I needed treatment to understand why I was capable of doing the things that I did and why I've made those choices. And going through treatment, I successfully graduated my treatment, and I understand myself better now as a person.
And so now you're on the sex offender registry, and I know you have to show up every once in a while to the law enforcement. You've got to let them know if you have a cell phone, if you change the cell phone, your IP address on your computer, all of those things. I wonder if when you go out in society, are you worried that people will identify you as somebody on the sex offender list, that someone's going to look you up, that you're going to have to answer for that? Is that an embarrassment to you? Is that something you've accepted? How do you live that right now?
Well, let me see. Best way to explain that is that I don't believe that I'm institutionalized mentally. So I live my life out here in society day to day. You know, and I'm very open with people that I meet about what I've done. So I'm not trying to hide it. We are not going to, like, when it comes to me, we're not going to be like associates, you know, for 2-3 years. And then, like, the end of the third year of our friendship, going on to the fourth year of our friendship, you find out that, okay, this guy has a background. He's been in prison for robbery and rape and this and that. I'm not going to, like, allow you to be taken by surprise with someone like that. For me, I'm upfront and personal. I let you know who I am, you know, where I've been and what I've done from the beginning. And when I do that, it's up to you to accept me as a person or not. I mean, everybody is not going to be happy with me. But I also understand that everybody is not meant to be my friend as well. You know, so it's like, hey, I'm not trying to run from what I did. I'm not trying to hide it. I mean, I made some bad decisions. You know, I cannot take those decisions back. And the harm that I've caused is going to last. You know, there's no limit on the harm that I caused. Although I've done 30 years in prison, you know, the people that I committed crimes against, they're going to live with the harm that I caused them for the rest of their life. So that's something that I understand. As far as, like, me being worried that people are going to find out who I am and what I've done, I do not really let that worry me, because I pretty much am willing to tell people who I am and what I've done, you know. And I mean, I can't take back the bad decisions or past things, because if I could, I would.
How would you, and again, I want to let people know that you're willing to come on and provide your full name and details and stuff like that. But for me, because you're still under, you have some obligations to a state that you live in, I prefer that you not. So I do appreciate your willingness, and that's why we're using the pseudonym Reggie, but I do appreciate that. I guess we're getting closer to the end here, and I wonder, you know, the people throw out terms that have meanings to different people, and one of the terms that I hear a lot in this area is rehabilitation, and I'm wondering, what does that word mean to you in terms of the crime that you committed and the experience you've had in prison and where you're at today?
For me, what does rehabilitation mean to me? for me to be rehabilitated, what for me it's just like it's a mirror, you know. So when I think about the word rehabilitation, I think about myself looking in the mirror and taking a real good deep look into my own eyes and knowing, okay, who I was in the past and who I am today. You know, if you met me, if you just met me at a grocery store, you know, in the church or anywhere, you would never just be able to be like this guy's been in the prison. You would never be able to just point me out of a crowd and be like, he's a bad guy. You know, so for me, being rehabilitated is like accepting me for who I am today, acknowledging what I've done in my past, you know, and just trying to be the best man that I can be today. So today, I'm not going to rob you. You don't have to worry about me robbing you for your money. You don't have to worry about me robbing you for your jewelry. I don't even wear jewelry. It's the thing. It's the thing of the past, you know. So it's like for me today, rehabilitation is like walking my life, you know, and remembering who I was and striving for who I want to be today. I have aspirations, you know. I want to live, you know, as good of a life as I can, you know, before I'm deceased. So I'm out here, and if I can, for me being rehabilitated means getting on a show like this, you know, and being willing to be open and honest about what I did.
What one thing, and we're getting again as we get closer to the end. I know you mentioned earlier on that the harm caused to the person that you sexually assaulted, that, you know, was without limits, if you will, and it could never be made whole. She could never be made whole again, or made you can't undo it. At the same time, I sense with you a desire to want to make amends in some way, and I'm wondering, how do you make amends, or how do you when you can't fully do it? And in this case, can't have contact with the person and wouldn't. What do you do to kind of add the positive, if you will, to the world, to somehow balance out the negative, and if that's even a calculation that you go through?
Oh. For me, I'm a spiritual person. I believe that there's a God. I believe in God with all my heart. And all I could do is, like, personally, is pray about it, you know. And I hope that that one day that the person I committed the crimes against will find it in her heart to forgive me for what I've done. I could never ask her for that, because it teaches that we've taken so much already that we don't have the right to ask for forgiveness. So I wouldn't ask for forgiveness. I would just pray that God touches her heart in a way, and her life in a way, that she can move on with her life. I have this, like, waking up having nightmares for the rest of her life and this and that. I would pray that that God gives her peace. So, and that's probably asking for a lot, but all I could do is really pray that she finds peace. Not with what I've done to her, because I don't believe she would ever find peace with that. I hope she finds an inner peace that allows her to move forward her life without reliving crimes that was committed upon her for the rest of her life, you know?
Reggie, thank you. I really appreciate your willingness to speak openly, to allow me to ask you some really difficult questions, and for helping me and helping our listeners understand you better. And I just wanted to say thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you for having me on, David.
Absolutely. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, send email inquiries and comments to kkfi.org/contact. This is Terry, reminding you that our outro music is Better Man from the Plane for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9, followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Link's Mix with Mixmaster Link, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo En...